Good morning. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Janine, and this is Get the Funk Out. Very excited to have two very special guests on this week's show. They are talking about their new book, MC5. It's Brad Talinsky and Jan Uhelski. This is an oral biography of rock's most revolutionary band, and I put all the information on the show blog. And that is getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org. It just came out, and I had a chance to interview Brad years ago when his book Eruption came out about Eddie Van Halen. And that was an incredible conversation. If you didn't have a chance to see that, it is on YouTube. I can throw a link up on the show blog later on. But this time, they are back. Well, Brad's back, and Jan's back to talk about this new book. They're with us now. Good morning. Do I have both of you?
I think so.
Yeah, all right, okay. We did it. Thank you to the listeners for your patience and standing by. I'm going to be in conversation with Brad Talinsky and Jan Uhelski. We're talking about MC5. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that, Janine. Thank you for having us on your great show.
Thank you.
I wrote a Van Halen book a few years back, and I came on your show, and we had a great time.
Oh, that was unbelievable. I had people, Brad, contacting me for a couple of years saying, can I get a copy of the book you were giving away? And I think we've had almost 20,000 views on that conversation. So next time we'll do something on camera, too. That was cool.
Yeah, well, and let's give away a copy of the book here, too.
That would be great. Okay, I'll mention that at the end, but I want to dive into how did the two of you connect and decide to write this book about this band?
I worked at Cream Magazine, the Detroit Rock Magazine, America's only rock and roll magazine.
Okay.
And one of my co-editors, Ben Edmonds, had been working on an MC5 book for years. He interviewed all the band members over a 10-year period and never wrote the book. It went years and years and years. I mean, maybe he started the interviews in 1990. And what happened was he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and called me and said, would you finish the book with me? And I said, sure. So I live in California, and I booked a flight to Detroit and stayed at his house for 3 weeks, and he hadn't had anything written, and I was kind of freaking out.
Sure.
What he had was banker boxes filled with handwritten transcripts. I mean, so many of them stacked to the ceiling. And for those 3 weeks, I went through them. And at the end of it, I go, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And I thought, okay, I kept working on him. I took some home and you know, started organizing a little bit. And he died like 8 months later.
Wow.
And so at that point, I go, I've got to honor this. Like, this sounds horrible, but this deathbed promise. And I called Brad, who I'd known for ages. We're both from Detroit.
Okay.
And I said, you've got to help me. We've got to do this. And it was one of those help, help, help calls, and he said yes. So we started going through all those boxes. Well, Ben's girlfriend scanned. She wouldn't let anything out of her sight because she was so bereft that he had passed away. And
of course,
we had that raw material scanned to us, and we started organizing it over. Oh my God, Brad, how long did it take us to just even organize it? Like years, like.
Yeah, it took us a long time. You know, Ben Edmonds, who Jan is talking about, he was a very respected writer, you know, himself. But he just had these, you know, these interviews and not much else for us to work with. So. You know, so it was a lot of material to go through, and then we had to sort of figure out how it fit together, and then we had to figure out what was missing.
Yeah.
So it was quite a process. I just want to take a step back. We can talk about this more if you want.
Go ahead.
But you know, the MC5 is, people might be familiar with the name, and they might not be.
Yeah.
I mean, their heyday was in the late 60s, And they only made like three records and had only one really gigantic sort of underground hit that your listeners might be familiar with called Kick Out the Jam.
Yeah, leave out the last word.
Yes.
Thanks,
but,
Brad.
But they were amazing, and we call our book an autobiography of rock's most revolutionary band. Mm-hmm. And they were indeed revolutionary, which is why Jan and I felt it was important to do this book to honor Ben, but also to honor the band and to honor Detroit, where it all came from. It was Detroit rock city music. And the reason they were so revolutionary, why we call them rock's most revolutionary band, was because they sort of helped invent the sound of hard rock and heavy metal and the attitude of punk rock.
Definitely.
But then in all of this, they stirred in like bits of free jazz, and their stage shows were legendary. I mean, they literally, each band member could dance like James Brown. And it was just chaos. It was a fantastic chaos in Detroit. And they have been sort of lost, but we felt it was really important to talk about them again, to talk mm-hmm. about their achievements. And the other interesting thing about the MC5 was not only were they great musicians, but they were also cultural revolutionaries.
Definitely, yes.
They helped create this sort of loose organization of kids called the White Panthers Party.
I saw that.
And you know, they were very early on. You could call them like the earliest sort of woke people. The White Panthers was basically put together to promote racial equality and legalizing marijuana and
anti-capitalist, you know, anti-racist. Yep.
Yeah.
Anti-capitalist, anti-racist. Vietnam War, of course, which was going on at that time, too.
Yeah. I think the big thing was is they actually thought, which I always love and I wish was much more true, is that music can make a difference. Music can change the world. And I remember near the end of his life, Wayne Kramer, the guitar player, who pretty much kept the MC5 name alive by different configurations of it with other players, with, you know, members of Soundgarden and the Melvins and whatever, but at the end he said, I asked him, did he still think that music could change the world? And he goes, no, it could change me, and that one person can make a difference. And they were really committed to that belief that,
I love that,
you know, maybe music is speaking to the tribe, and together the tribe can do something. But but I always loved that part of it. I mean, I was a White Panther teenager. It was a lot like being part of the KISS Army, but with better intentions. You know, you weren't just aggrandizing KISS. You were, you really thought you could do something, and you were part of something, which meant a lot in the late 60s and early 70s.
Definitely. They had such a profound influence on punk rock, hard rock, alternative rock. I mean, I think about the Sex Pistols, the Clash, Nirvana. I mean, so much influence.
Yeah, you know, Rage Against the Machine. Mm-hmm. They were a huge influence on their sort of fusion of hard rock and politics. And but we even got, like, you know, Billy Idol wrote a quote for our book. He was a big promoter of the band, and Alice Cooper, you know, was influenced by them. Yeah, they had a huge impact on
Don't forget Sonic Youth. Sonic Youth took their name from Fred Sonic Smith, the other guitar player. So, and their idea of free noise, they used to call it avant rock, which was very Sun Ryan and, you know, jazzy, and that was the part that Sonic Youth related to, and I always loved that. I mean, I had not known that until maybe 10 years ago. So, Amazing.
For listeners just tuning in, I'm in conversation with Brad Tilinski and Jan Uhelski. We're talking about MC5, an oral biography of rock's most revolutionary band. Now, MC5 stands for Motor City 5. And again, if you're tuning in, they were an American rock band formed in 64 in Lincoln Park, Michigan. And so much influence. So I know several of the band members are no longer alive. Is there a lot of footage of performances? I mean, I could see you making a documentary.
I wish. I think there's one show, maybe one song of them at Wayne State University, Tarter Field, from 1970. I mean, there's little scraps. You can see bad footage when they played the Democratic Convention in 1968.
Okay.
There really is very little. It wasn't what people were doing back in the late 60s. You know, the fact that the documentation of this band was really slight. I mean, we had those interviews.
I mean, you know, you take something and you're sort of like, well, that's sort of remarkable, this influential band. Why isn't there more footage? But even if you take a band that even came along in the 70s, like Led Zeppelin, I mean, there's
just Super 8
footage. You know, in considering how big Led Zeppelin was, there's not that much footage of them. I mean, until they made their own movie. So it just you know, there were no cell phones.
No, it would have to be like Super 8 footage. You know.
Yeah. But there is, like, if your listeners want to go up there, there are some, like, really a couple of classic performance, like, of one or two songs by them, and you can sort of see them in action. And there's a lot of action going on stage.
Oh, definitely, yes. Mm-hmm. So they were pretty much involved in punk rock, right? But they did rock, blues, jazz, things like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, to some degree, they created punk rock. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like that they were, you know, involved. It wasn't even called punk rock back then.
Yeah.
It's just that they were doing rock and roll, and they were doing it with a very defiant attitude, you know, socially and politically. They were, you know, they were almost criminalized for using the mother blanca word on one of their records. So a lot of the people that came after them, people that we call punk rockers, like the Ramones and
Clash.
And Billy Idol and the Sex Pistols, sort of took a created punk rock by listening and looking at what they did.
Well, they had, you know, kind of this aggressive style to them and this political edge.
Mm-hmm.
It was cool.
And they were musically aggressive. They were dangerous. They were in your face. I mean, Wayne Kramer would pretty much, like, tear off notes like it was flinging insults at people. You know, they had... If you see the cover of the book, they all have this stinking attitude. Like they're actually beautiful men. Mm-hmm. That, let me be girl for a second, and incredibly good looking. But they're like the kind of guys that you would probably just not want to date. You know, because you look at them and they were dangerous, and they've got that "don't f with me" kind of look in their eyes, and they are. As dangerous as they are revolutionary, or were.
It's funny. I was thinking about this the other day, and you know, at the time, sort of the standard, like the biggest, you know, what you would think of is punks or punk rockers at that time were the Rolling Stones, and. They sort. You listen to the first MC5 record compared to what the Rolling Stones were playing at the time, like Beggar's Banquet or something, and it almost makes the Stones sound quaint in comparison. I mean, they were so loud and aggressive on their debut record that it's almost shocking when you compare it to what else was going on during the day.
Sure. Yeah. Tell me about the process for writing the book, because it feels like I have a background, you know, interviewing people, even for, you know, qualitative research. What was this like, pulling this all together? Because this is pretty tedious.
It was like writing a play. You know, it was taking the raw material, and Spread said he interviewed John Lando, we interviewed John Sinclair, who was their manager and so-called king of the hippies in Detroit. He was the one who was jailed for having two marijuana cigarettes, and he was in jail for about a year and a half, and he's the one who's also, John Lennon wrote a song about and went to benefit to raise awareness to about this, you know, crime that was barely a crime. So
yeah,
one of John Lennon's very, very few post-Beatles gigs was doing a benefit concert for the MC5's manager, John Sinclair, who had been busted for two joints and thrown in jail for, was supposed to be 10 years. I mean, it was...
For two joints, 10 years.
Wow. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And wrote a song about John on Sometime in New York record as mm-hmm. well. But the... yeah, as Jan was saying, I mean, we had a lot of this raw material, but the thing is a lot of it was really, really compelling. These guys were pretty brilliant, like all of them, not only the band, but the people they surrounded themselves with. Their music might have been, you know, a bit crude and aggressive, but they were incredibly articulate and funny and interesting in and of themselves. So we decided to just take their dialogue and let them tell the story.
That's great.
But piecing that together so it would make sense to somebody who didn't know anything about the band was a complicated process. But, you know, I have to say, I've been writing for, you know, a good 30 years, and the thing about this book is, it really tells one of the greatest stories I've ever encountered. Really, such a wild and strange story that even if you knew nothing about the band's music, you would be fascinated by it, because it's almost like a little tour of late 60s history, because they were at the Democratic National Convention.
Yeah.
You know, they were there during the Detroit riots, you know, all these people come in and out, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, mm-hmm. John Lennon, you know, they're all part of their story.
And I like part of it. I like,
you know,
the
we were able to tell the
story
in their words, which is pretty incredible.
Sure.
Well, they tell on each other, you know, it's like nothing's held back. It's like everybody decided enough time had gone by, so let's just tell the real story. But the real story isn't negative, really. It's funny. It's like they may contradict each other. But even things like Fred Smith, who was the guitar player who went on to marry Patti Smith later, he had a temper, and the bass player from Cream, the power trio from the 60s, Jack Bruce, complained to the owner of the Grandy Ballroom, where the MC5 were the house band, that Fred was rude. But he didn't even see the rude that he really was. There was a time they were playing in Seattle with Jethro Tull, and the lead singer, Ian Anderson, had said something to Fred, called him a bloody colonist, and Fred just threw his orange juice in his face. So there are moments like that. They're completely rock moments.
Yeah.
But it's like they play off each other so well. Like, you know, someone will tell the story, or they scare Janis Joplin, who was pretty scary herself as a human. And it's the small stories I like, or just they were one of the people who lived communally, which is also like a relic of the late 60s, early 70s. But you see the dynamics of the women in the house couldn't eat with the men, they couldn't wear eyeliner, and they talk about that. The Stooges' guitar player, Ron Ashton, is a really good like source. He's in there quite a bit, giving like a insider outsider view of what was happening. So there's a lot of really, really funny characters who chime in.
Definitely.
Like that.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about Danny Fields. So he signed the band?
Mm-hmm, he did sign them, as well as the Stooges, for lesser money. Danny Fields is the A&R man. He actually was one of the editors at 16 Magazine, the teen magazine from the 60s. And then he worked for Elektra Records, and two friends of his who were, they were called Cocaine Karma. They were Dennis Frawley and Bob Rednick, had somehow found out about the MC5, turned Danny onto it. They went to Detroit and saw the MC5, and he was pretty dazzled at how strange and how great and how powerful this band was, and went back and told Elektra Records he'd found this band. And he, again, they used to call the Stooges, who were part of the same scene, their little brother band. So I'm not sure. I think it was $10,000 they signed for, and then they got the Stooges for a bargain for $5,000 through that end. But Danny again, like Ron Ashton, is really one of the people who see the MC5 for who they are without being part of it. So the things he says are really colorful, really funny, and very dry. If you've seen the documentary Danny Says, which is about him basically managing and finding the Ramones as well, he is a genius. And he's a really big player in this, too.
Yeah.
Danny, I mean, he's hilarious. It's really a high point of the book is anytime Danny speaks, he's always got a great story or a great anecdote. And he started out as a publicist for the Doors, so he was one of these zealot figures that you see going all across the 60s and the 70s. And I think at one point in the book, the singer Rob Tyner from the MC5 said that he took a peek at Danny Fields' Rolodex, and Danny's Rolodex had like Pablo Picasso, Marlena Dietrich, just all these legendary people that Danny could talk to or call anytime, and that was basically because he himself was such an entertaining and interesting person.
It sounds like it.
And that's sort of what, it's a testimony, I suppose, to the MC5 and to the Stooges that somebody like him would see them and say, this is remarkable. This is something that people have to hear. This is really interesting.
Right. Yeah. So what has been the, the feedback you've gotten so far in the book?
Well, just actually yesterday, we were named on the short list in Mojo magazine as one of the books of the year, as one of the music books
Fantastic.
Of the year. Mojo magazine, for your listeners that might not be familiar with it, is sort of, it's a UK magazine. It's basically, I don't know, I'd say it's like one of
Rolling
the most respected, if not the most respected music magazine. And for them to have taken our book and listed it in their top 10 music books of the year was a huge, huge honor, really.
I love that. That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Well, it's really, part of it's about the music and discovering this band and who they are.
Yeah.
They aren't household names. They aren't The Who. They aren't the Rolling Stones. But I think anybody picking up this book and that likes music and likes the history of the 60s and the, those sort of radical times, which Lord knows we could use more of these days,
yeah.
I think we'll find something, something interesting about the book. And you know, it'll force you to go back and listen to the music, and hopefully you find it as, you know, as exciting as we did.
One thing I didn't touch on is, so they broke up in 72, right?
Yeah, they broke up in 72.
Would you say, I mean, I know, you know, there were drugs, and what do you think led to this happening?
I think it was the downside of being radical. There was a cascading series of events beginning with using that word, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then that overshadowed who they were, that they were a band who had this heckle that they would heckle like other bands who they thought were subpar. It became a war cry and then became a war of censorship. And beginning with that, that got them kicked off of Elektra Records. And there were just, over the book, you'll see all these tiny moments where this band, who was on the cover of Rolling Stone before their first record even was released and had such promise and such talent, lost it step by step, little moments. And I've said this before, but it's like a horror movie, and the gang of teenagers are going down the basement where there's razor blades hanging, and you want to say, don't do that, don't do that, please don't go there.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. There's just a series of events and happenstance that I can't say prevents them, but you want the ending to be different. When the book ends, you go, oh, it shouldn't have ended that way.
Right.
They should have done this. It's a band with great promise, and it was promise dashed. It's like a fractured fairy tale.
Go ahead, Brad. Did you want to wrap up and share something?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really, it's really the essence of the book and the interesting part of their story is both their rise and their fall. There's all these crazy events that lead up to both of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they had a moment where it was, everything was coming together for them. They were on the cover of Rolling Stone. Their record, their album was heading to the top of the charts. And then all of a sudden, there are four or five events that happened to them, all on top of each other, that create this ultimate fall for them. And that is just a big part of the book. I mean, you know. If that sounds interesting to
don't give anything away. All right, so
they have to go out and buy the book now.
And that leads me to tell them it's available from Hatchet, but they can get the book really anywhere, right? It's on Amazon and everywhere.
Yes. Yeah.
Very cool.
Just type in, you know, MC5.
Mm-hmm.
An oral biography of rock's most revolutionary band, or just MC5 and revolutionary band, it'll probably come up.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And so I just want to thank you both for calling in. I've been speaking with Brad Tulinski and Jan Uhelski, and Ben Edmonds is also part of the book.
Yes.
He was a pivotal role in shaping music culture. And so thank you so much for both calling in, and congratulations. Where are you both? Are you both in L.A., or Brad, you're in New York?
I'm in New York.
Okay. All right.
And I'm in Palm Desert, California.
Palm Desert, okay. Well, I loved how you
I could walk there.
Well, this is fantastic. Congratulations. It's great you collaborated on this. It's a very important book of music history.
Thank you so much for having us on, Janine.
Absolutely. Be well.
Thanks,
thank
Janine.
You. If you missed any part of my conversation with Brad Tulinski and Jan Uhelski, it will be up as a podcast at the top of the hour after I wrap. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll take a little break, and then we'll be back.